Okay, good morning, everybody. No, you should just know something about the blood clotting mechanism called, what's it called? It's called coagulation. Yeah, coagulation, and what the bottom line for coagulation. Probably you should know the three steps that control coagulation, which is what? Prothrombin activator formation, thrombin formation, and then fibrin formation. You should know something about active and inactive forms. You should probably know why that coagulation scheme is so complicated. Why does it have so many steps? And you should know that one of the steps is a positive feedback mechanism. When thrombin feeds back to the intrinsic pathway, right, that makes more thrombin, which makes more activating factors, which makes more thrombin. And why is there positive feedback? Because it makes coagulation happen very fast, very quickly, so you don't bleed to death. All right, what are some other things? Calcium is important. Phospholipids are important. Where are those clotting factors made? Mostly in the liver. Maybe what kinds of vitamins are necessary, like vitamin K. So those kinds of things. So you don't have to memorize all those steps, but you should at least know that fibrin formation is coagulation. And where does fibrin come from? Fibrinogen. And what converts fibrinogen to fibrin? That's an important step. Then that is thrombin. And thrombin comes from prothrombin. And what activates prothrombin or converts? Yeah, it's a prothrombin activator. That's the first step. Okay, prothrombin activator. So that's kind of the level that I want. But I want you to be able to contrast it with agglutination. What kind of reaction is agglutination? Is it a cascade of enzymatic reactions like coagulation? Oh, it's just a simple antigen-antibody reaction, right? So a totally different thing. Okay. On Blackboard this morning, I was able to put on the review figure for the cardiac cycle that's in your lab book, so you can print that out a number of times. Somebody asked me what figure it was. It's very similar to one that I'm going to show you. Actually, maybe I would download it when we get to that point in the lecture today. It's the exam figure that you have to know about pressures and volumes and ECG and the different heart sounds. Okay, so you can download that. And also I'll put the answer key to that figure in Blackboard too. Okay, so some people have problems generating blood clots inappropriately, and when they start to float around inside the cardiovascular system, that forms a thrombus that can plug up a blood vessel that might go to your lungs or might go to your brain or to your heart, and then whatever part of that organ that's being nourished by that blood vessel is going to die as a result of that. So you're going to have a heart attack or stroke or pulmonary embolism. All of those things can be fatal, but certainly debilitating. So some patients have to be on anticoagulation therapy to control those blood clots. And most commonly used is Coumarin. That blocks coagulation by inhibiting activation of vitamin K. And vitamin K works indirectly by reducing calcium availability for the clotting mechanism. Other kinds of anticoagulants that can be used would be heparin. That activates antithrombin 3, that blocks thrombin, so that's going to then block fibrin formation. And then there's a number of things that we can use. Sometimes when we draw blood from people, we don't want it to coagulate in the test tube, like what would happen normally. And sometimes we put chemicals in the test tube to keep it a fluid, and those things are going to be calcium chelators, things that take calcium out of solution, like EDTA or sodium citrate. So you can store blood as a fluid form for a long time, just in glassware, so it doesn't coagulate. All right, pulmonary and systemic circulations. This is just a review from anatomy, so I don't think I'm really going to go over much of this kind of stuff, but you know that the heart is a two-sided pump. There's a right side and a left side. The right side pumps blood through the pulmonary circulation, and the left side pumps blood through the systemic circulation. You should know the definitions of arteries and veins, and you should probably know some examples of what kinds of arteries carry oxygenated blood and which carry deoxygenated blood. Right? So knowing the condition of the blood in terms of the state of oxygen or CO2 doesn't define whether a blood vessel is an artery or a vein. So who knows a good definition of an artery that works in every single case? That's right. An artery is just a blood vessel that takes blood away from the heart, right? And it doesn't matter if it's oxygenated or deoxygenated. So a pretty good question would be, give me the name of an artery that is carrying deoxygenated blood. Like the pulmonary? Did somebody say pulmonary? The pulmonary artery, right. And what's the name of a vein that's carrying oxygenated blood? Yeah, the pulmonary vein. So the pulmonary circulation is opposite compared to what you would think about for the systemic circulation, right? So here's pulmonary artery, deoxygenated. Here are pulmonary veins that are oxygenated. And then here's the aorta, which is oxygenated. That's an artery. And then here's a vena cava, which is deoxygenated. Okay. I guess one thing that I will mention about the structure of the heart, you should be familiar with this already, but in particular, we're going to talk about the fibrous skeleton. This is formed by dense regular connective tissue. It's a layer right between the atria and the ventricles. All right, so the whole heart is not made up of contractile cells or myocardium. There is a layer of dense connective tissue between the atria and the ventricles, which is going to be important for our discussion in just a little bit. Okay. One thing that I will mention in this section, though, the amount of blood that is pumped by the left ventricle through the systemic circulation, right, on average has to be equal to the amount of blood that is pumped by the right ventricle through the pulmonary circulation. All right, and I don't know if that's really obvious to people, but what might happen if the left ventricle is pumping more blood than the right ventricle? If the left ventricle is pumping more than the, I'm sorry, I confused myself. If the left ventricle is pumping more blood than the right ventricle, what's going to happen? Then there's going to be fluid or blood backing up into the systemic circulation, right? And if that persists, then you're going to have more blood backing up into the systemic circulation, more and more blood, and, right, then that's not possible to have happen. So the ventricles have to pump the same amount of blood because, right, it's just a continuous looping circuit. Okay. And what can you tell me about the size of the left ventricle compared to the right ventricle? Which one's bigger and stronger? The left is much bigger and stronger because it has to pump blood through the whole systemic circulation. The right ventricle is a lot weaker because it only has to pump blood through the lungs. So the left ventricle is hypertrophied, and in order to get blood through the whole systemic circulation, the pressure has to be a lot higher, all right, in the systemic circulation compared to the pulmonary circulation. Oh, and here you can see the fibrous skeleton of the heart, all right, that's going to be separating the atria from the ventricles. All right. It acts as a place of insertion for the myocardial muscles, but it also acts as a point of insertion for the valves as well. So the valves are nice and tightly anchored within the myocardium. Okay. Heart valves. Yeah, you're familiar with heart valves already. Well, here is that fibrous skeleton again. All right, you got these two atrioventricular valves, and here's a semilunar valve, and there's another semilunar valve that we can't see, which is the aortic down over here. So just make sure you know the names of these things and what side of the heart they're on. Okay. Cardiac cycle. Now, this is going to be important, so we're going to pick up our discussion here. All right, the cardiac cycle is a repeating pattern of contraction and relaxation. So your heart is a pump. It's designed to pressurize blood so that it will flow through the cardiovascular system. And how is blood going to flow? Or how does any fluid flow? Okay, it's going to flow down a gradient of some kind. And what's the gradient? Just like diffusion, the motive force for diffusion is a concentration gradient, right? Fluid will flow down a gradient. What kind of gradient is that going to be? It's not really concentration, it's pressure, right? So the heart pressurizes blood, and the heart ejects that pressurized blood into an artery, and it's going to flow from high pressure, which is an artery, all the way through the circulatory system into a vein, which is low pressure. Okay. And the heart is not like an electric motor that once you plug it in and turn it on, that will continuously pump a fluid. Right? It's what we call a reciprocating pump. That means sometimes the heart is pumping and sometimes the heart is not pumping. So it has these two phases. And when the heart is pumping, that happens during contraction. And when it's not pumping blood, that happens during relaxation. And those two phases have these specific terms. Systole refers to the contraction phase of the heart, and diastole refers to the relaxation phase of the heart. And they're followed by each other. So you have a period of diastole followed by systole, followed by diastole again, and the heart just keeps working and pumping blood. All right, both atria contract simultaneously, the two top chambers, and that follows by contraction of the two lower ventricles. So the atria contract together, there's a slight delay, and then the ventricles contract again. We'll take a little bit greater look at that in just a little bit. Probably you should have a pretty good feel for what the blood pressure is between the two different circulations. Normal systemic blood pressure should be about 120 over 80. And why do you have these two numbers right here? Because one represents a systolic pressure and the lower number represents the diastolic pressure. And the pressure in your blood is going to decrease to, say, 80 millimeters of mercury, and then the heart's going to contract again, and it gets boosted back up to 120. All right, so it's just going to oscillate between 120 and 80 under normal circumstances. What do we call it if it's greater than this number? If the systolic or diastolic or both are greater than this number, what do we call that? That's hypertension or high blood pressure. And that is deadly. That should be treated, right? It accumulates cardiovascular disease if you leave it go untreated. Okay. Now, the pulmonary blood pressure, notice that it's a lot lower, right? It doesn't need the same kind of force to push blood through the pulmonary circulation. So a typical blood pressure is maybe around 25 over 10. So it's a lot lower blood pressure, all right? And does anybody know how to measure this blood pressure? Has anybody ever measured this one? You measure systemic all the time with just a pressure cuff on your arm, but how would you measure pulmonary pressure? Where do you have to go to find pulmonary pressure? Yeah, deep inside your thoracic cavity, so it's relatively difficult to get a measurement of that pressure. It's not anything that you can do easily, right? Maybe you need a surgical technique or an echocardiogram or some kind of fancy instrumentation to get that kind of blood pressure. So it's not commonly known, but pulmonary hypertension is just as deadly as systemic hypertension. As a matter of fact, we never even say systemic hypertension because hardly anybody knows anything about their pulmonary blood pressure. Okay, and so if somebody does have pulmonary hypertension, that's going to lead to heart failure, just like systemic hypertension, and it's also going to kill the lungs. And so when somebody's in heart failure because of pulmonary hypertension, all right, and they need a new heart, guess what else they need that's new? They also need a new lung, right? So they're a candidate for a heart-lung transplant. So it's important to know something about pulmonary hypertension, even though it's pretty hard to measure. Okay, cardiac cycle. Let's talk about some definitions. Well, we have what we call the end diastolic volume of the heart. So again, what is diastole? That's when the heart is relaxing. And what happens when the heart is relaxing? Is blood being pumped out or is blood filling? It's filling the heart, right? And right at the end of diastole, that's the end of the period of time when the heart has filled the most. So end diastolic volume is the biggest heart volume, right? That's after it's filled up all the way. And it's important for the heart to be able to relax so that it can fill up with blood. All right, so because if the heart doesn't fill up with blood, it might be able to contract with a lot of vigor and contract, but if there's no blood in the heart when it contracts, is it going to pump any blood out? No. So both phases of the cardiac cycle are very important. If either one misbehaves, then cardiac function is going to be reduced. All right, so end diastolic volume is the large volume at the end of diastole. Stroke volume is the amount of blood that's ejected from the ventricles when the heart beats. Every time the heart beats, it pumps out a certain amount of blood. and that's the stroke volume. And then our last volume right here is what we call the end systolic volume. That is the amount of blood that's left in the ventricles at the end of systole. So when the heart contracts, it doesn't pump out 100% of the blood that's in the ventricle. It might pump out, in a good heart, maybe 60%, something like that. That means 40% is left inside the ventricle. It might get pumped out next time. Okay, but that's the end systolic volume. That's the small one. So you should be able to calculate the stroke volume knowing the end diastolic volume and the end systolic volume, and you can see it's just what? One minus the other. Which one are you going to subtract from the other one? What would be a good formula for calculating stroke volume? Yeah, it's going to be end diastolic volume minus end systolic volume. All right, so that gives you a nice positive number, and that's just the amount of blood that's pumped out by the heart. All right, so here are just some review questions. Which is larger, the ESV? Oh, okay, this must have been way too late. Which is larger, end systolic volume and, let's say, end diastolic volume? Okay, the diastolic volume is much bigger, right, because that's after the heart fills. All right, what's the stroke volume? If the end systolic volume is 20 and the end diastolic volume is 80 milliliters. Yeah, so it's just one minus the other, or 60. So you see how easy that is. And actually, I think that might be one of the quantitative questions that you have at the end of the chapter that you have to look at, right? There's a graph in the book that you have to look at and read the numbers off the graph and then calculate these different numbers. Okay. Continuing on with the cardiac cycle, right, as the ventricles contract, pressure rises. That's the job of the ventricles. And when the pressure inside the ventricles goes higher than the atria, that's when the atrioventricular valves are going to close. All right, so now the AV valves are closed and the semilunar valves are closed. So the heart is going to contract, but blood can't leave because all the valves are closed. We call this the isovolumetric contraction, because all the heart valves are closed, right? And then when pressure in the ventricles exceeds that in the aorta, then the semilunar valves open and ejection begins. So then the ventricles start to eject blood from the ventricles into the major arteries, right? And then as the pressure in the ventricles fall below that in the aorta, all right, then the semilunar valves closes, blood tries to go backwards again. All right, and then all valves are closed at the end of that systolic period. And again, the heart starts to relax, but all the valves are closed. So again, we call this the isovolumetric period of relaxation. All right, and when the pressure in the ventricles falls below the atria, then blood in the atria can move into the ventricles. So the atrioventricular valves open, and the ventricle starts to fill. All right, and then the last thing after the ventricles are filled, an atrial systole. That means what? That's when the atria start to contract, right? That's when the atria pump a little bit of blood into the ventricles. Okay, so here is a figure that you should know from your lab book, and this is the figure that I just put on Blackboard for you. Because this one's pretty good, but the one that I might have on the test is the one that's in your lab book. Yeah, question. Oh, I'm going to show you on this chart right here, which is really, really nice. Okay. All right, so when you start to look at a graph, what's the first thing that your eye should actually, your understanding, what should you understand about a graph? How the axes are labeled so you know what you're looking at, right? So here is a vertical axis, here's a horizontal axis. So the horizontal axis is just time, right? The vertical axis has a number of different kinds of values. This first one right here is just sound. Right, the second one right here, this is just voltage, right, from electrodes that you place on the surface of somebody's body, and you did this in lab already. I'm sure you did ECGs in lab, right? This third trace right here is a volume, like cubic centimeters or milliliters of a ventricle, and you can see how the volume of a ventricle changes through the cardiac cycle. And then the top trace, which is what we're going to talk about first, is pressure. Right, pressure versus time through the cardiac cycle. All right, so we got three pressure tracings on this particular graph. All right, this, I forget, is that blue? Yeah, good enough, blue right here. Okay, you can see, how does a pressure in this blue graph, which is ventricular pressure, right? So this is pressure inside a ventricle. What does it vary between? What is the lowest pressure that you see in a ventricle? Zero. And what's the highest pressure? Yeah, 120. So pressure inside the ventricle varies from zero. And guess when is the pressure zero inside a ventricle? When it's contracting or relaxing? When it's relaxed. Yeah, that makes perfect sense, right? So when the ventricles don't pressurize the blood, the blood's going to have basically zero pressure. And then as the heart starts, the ventricles start to contract, guess what happens to the pressure? It increases until you get the peak systole right here, and that's 120. All right, so this is ventricular contraction. Now, this is really a handy graph because we get to see how different events inside the heart are coordinated. So let's look at the ECG. All right, so here is the P wave, here's the QRS and the T wave. And so the QRS complex right here is the signal for contraction, ventricular contraction. Does the QRS happen at the same time or after or before contraction of the ventricles? Yeah, can you see it happens before? So the electrical activity of the heart, namely the ECG, is a signal for contraction. It's really, it's just a signal. It's not contraction itself. All right? And so then after the QRS complex, the heart starts to contract, and then here is peak contraction right here. All right, so it's nice to see how these mechanical events correspond to electrical events inside the heart. All right, so this line right here, does it have any color for you? No? Just kind of looks like dark brown or something? Black maybe? Huh? Same color as everything else. Okay. So this right here is pressure inside the atria. Okay. And so pressure inside the atria at this point in time is higher than pressure inside the aorta. So which way is blood going to flow? I'm sorry. Atria versus the ventricle. So remember, blood is going to flow from high pressure to low. Blood is going to flow from an atria into a ventricle during this whole period of time right here. But we see that these lines cross over each other right here. Right? This is right when the ventricles start to contract, and now the pressure is higher in the ventricle than the atria. So blood is going to try to flow backwards into the atria, but what's going to prevent that? There's a valve, an AV valve, right? And so the AV valve closes, and so blood cannot flow into the atria once that valve closes. So the AV valve is closed, and the semilunar valves are closed, so this is the period of time when the heart starts to contract, but blood can't leave the ventricles because all the valves are closed. So this is what we call the period between these two vertical lines right here, the period of isovolumetric contraction because all the valves are closed. And then as the heart contracts more and more strongly, the pressure in the ventricles exceeds pressure in the aorta. And then right at this point where they cross over, that's going to open up the aortic semilunar valve, and blood is now ejected from the ventricle. Okay? And then as the heart starts to relax, so this blue line actually should come over to about this location right here, and in your lab book it shows you that in the correct location. So now the pressure in the ventricles, right, is lower than pressure in the aorta, and so guess what happens right here? Blood tries to flow back from the aorta into the ventricle right at this point, and guess what happens? That shouldn't happen, so the aortic semilunar valve closes at this point in time. Okay? All right. So here are the heart sounds. Here's the first heart sound. It begins at the beginning of systole. What's happening right here at the beginning of systole? Blood tries to squirt back into the atria, but it can't, because the AV valves slam closed, that produces the first heart sound. All right, and then the second heart sound happens when the semilunar valves slam closed, when blood from the aorta tries to flow back into the ventricles. All right, that's the second heart sound, and those are the only two heart sounds that I'm going to want you to know about in this class. Okay, so it's important to see how to read these graphs right here. Okay, the other thing that we can look at then is the volume of the ventricles. Okay, so here is, so what period of the heart cycle is this right in through here? Is it systole or diastole of the ventricle? This is diastole, right, because here is systole of the ventricle right here. All right, so here is the volume of the ventricles. The ventricles are not contracting. And what's happening during diastole? This is when they actually fill with blood, right? So the volume is going to increase. So you see a little bump in the ventricular volume because what happens during the P wave? The P wave is a signal for what? Yeah, electrical activity. That's going to signal contraction of the atria. And what's the job of the atria? To push a little blood where? Into the ventricles, and here you see the blood, the little bit of blood that's being pushed into the ventricles from the atria that increases the volume of the ventricles a little bit. Okay, and so here is the volume of the ventricles is not changing during this period of time, but then as the aortic valve opens, guess what happens? You have ejection of the blood. Okay, so this would be the end systolic volume. And guess what volume this is right here? That's the end diastolic volume. So these two volumes right here define how much blood is ejected from the heart during systole. What do we call that number? That's the stroke volume of the heart. Okay? So you might have to be able to calculate that. So it's just end diastolic volume minus end systolic volume. So this difference right here is the stroke volume of the heart. Okay, so this is a pretty good figure to look at. Okay. Question?
So on the blue line.
Okay, blue line.
The pressure,
yes.
In the case of hypertension, when it goes far up, does that have to do with the rate of contraction of
the ventricles? You mean the slope of this line right here? Yeah, the slope might have to be greater. Yeah, but the slope has to be greater because usually contraction is about the same period of time.
How would it get greater? Is it because of the rate of contraction from the ventricle?
You know, we never talk about that in this class. Okay, how does it get greater? You know, we'll take a look at some blood pressure and why blood pressure increases, but we don't talk about how the heart changes its internal activity necessarily. Okay? Only in one respect, maybe. The force of contraction increases, and when we get to that slide, I'll mention it. Okay? But I don't want to make that too complicated. Okay? And what would hypertension be? Instead of 120, this pressure would be, what, 130, 140, 150, 160, something like that, okay? And when the pressure is much higher in the aorta, say 160, what does a heart have to do? It has to pump harder, right, to get blood from the ventricles into the aorta. It's got to develop a lot more pressure. So the heart has to work harder when the aortic pressure is higher than 120, right? And that's eventually what's going to wear the heart out. Okay. All right, so here are the heart sounds that we talked about. Closing of the AV valve is due to the first heart sound, right? Closing of the semilunar valves, that's a second heart sound. Maybe you learned that in anatomy. I'm not really too sure. Okay, heart murmurs. There can be abnormal sounds produced by the heart if there are abnormal patterns of blood flow through the heart. All right, so we only looked at the normal circumstances. And so if there's damage to a valve of the heart, then it's going to make different kinds of noises, which we call a murmur. Right? Many are caused by defective heart valves. They could be congenital in origin. Maybe a heart valve didn't develop properly in the prenatal period. All right? But it can also be damaged by infections, viral infections or bacterial infections. Rheumatic fever, for instance, damages the valves because your body produces antibodies. Okay, in response to the streptococcus bacteria, that you've been infected with, and those antibodies actually attack the valve. So there's a cross-reaction between antibodies that somebody makes to fight an infection. Those antibodies attack the person's own heart, which is pretty unfortunate when that happens. That's an autoimmune disease. Another example of thinking of an autoimmune disease, Streptococcus mutans and various kinds of lactobacilli cause dental caries, which are cavities, right? So cavities in your teeth are produced by bacteria that live on glucose that we eat, and they secrete an acid, and that dissolves your teeth away. Well, somebody came up with a fantastic idea and said, you know what, we can produce a vaccine against these bacteria, so they won't live in your body, all right? So when you are given a vaccine, your body learns how to make antibodies against these bacteria, and that vaccine worked really nicely. So you might be wondering, how come we just don't all get immunized against cavities and then nobody would have cavities anymore? Well, there was a problem with that, and that is when it was never allowed to be tried on humans, because it was found that when the vaccine was tried on animals, those animals developed antibodies against their own heart tissue. So indeed, you could be vaccinated against dental caries, but the side effect would be what? You would lose your heart as a result of that. Okay, so that's really not a good option, because those antibodies not only would attack the Streptococcus and Lactobacilli, but it would also attack the individual's heart tissue and kill the heart. Okay, so that's a really good reason to have a nice, strong FDA. Okay. All right, so different kinds of heart sounds that you can hear could be due to a couple of different kinds of pathology. All right, a valve has to not only close properly, but a valve has to open properly. All right, so a valve has to be open for blood to go across it, and it has to close properly to stop retrograde flow. In mitral stenosis, the valve becomes thickened and calcified, and so it doesn't open properly. It doesn't open all the way. So when blood flows past it, it makes a swishing sound, right, which you can hear with a stethoscope. All right, and then the ventricle doesn't fill properly, and there's leftover blood in the atrium. So blood has a tendency to stagnate in an atrium. And guess what happens when blood stands still? Guess what it likes to do? It likes to coagulate, right? And that's one of the last places you want to have coagulation, and that is at some place in your cardiovascular system, like your heart, generating blood clots, because they're going to go to brain causing a stroke or heart causing a heart attack. Okay, so that valve probably should be repaired or replaced. And that accumulation of blood in the left atrium can back up the whole pulmonary circulation, causing pulmonary hypertension, which means now that the right ventricle has to pump a lot more pressure than it normally does, and that's going to wear out the heart and eventually kill the heart as well. So stenosis is due to an improperly opening valve, right? The other case is when valves don't close properly. We call that an insufficient valve or an incompetent valve. And when a valve doesn't close properly, when the ventricle contracts, blood is going to be squirt back up into the atrium, and it's going to make a squeaking or squirting sound. And sometimes that could be due to damage to papillary muscles or damage to the heart valve leaflets themselves. And again, that can be due to bacterial infections, could be a congenital or a viral infection. And that condition will eventually kill the heart as well, so that valve needs to be repaired or replaced. Okay, so those are valves, but there can be other kinds of heart defects. For instance, the wall between the chambers of the heart, what do we call this wall between chambers of the heart? That's a septum, right? Here's the interventricular septum. There's an interatrial septum. And remember, in the prenatal period, during gestation, there should be a hole between the atria. What do we call that hole between the atria in the fetal circulation? That's the foramen is a hole. Okay, fossa is a depression. I like foramen. Foramen ovale, right? Foramen ovale. Because blood should bypass the pulmonary circulation, because before you're born, you're not using your lungs. So blood should move from the right atrium directly into the left atrium, right? And so here is that foramen ovale, and then when you're born, in the postnatal period, this foramen ovale should close over and form the fossa ovale, or fossa ovalis. All right, in some people it doesn't close. As a matter of fact, some people, they don't really realize that they have PFO until maybe they're in their 40s or 50s when their heart starts to fail, and then it's repaired, it's closed for them. So there might be even somebody in this room that has a PFO, right? And so when I say PFO, what is that? Foramen ovale, right? Foramen ovale, that's a hole in the atrial septum, and this P just stands for patent. Patent means that it's open. Like if you have a blood vessel and blood can flow through it, it's patent. If you have a blood vessel and blood can't flow through it, it's not patent, it's what we call what? Occluded. Patent is open, occluded means it's blocked. All right, so a PFO is what we call a patent foramen ovale. And when blood squirts through there, it's going to make a squeaking sound. All right, and the same thing for the septum right here. If there's a hole in the interventricular septum, okay, you can see blood, which way is blood squirting in this interventricular septum? From left to right, right? Left ventricle to right ventricle. And does it always go that way? And why? Which way does fluid flow? By pressure, from high pressure to low. And what ventricle develops more pressure? Left. It has 120 over 80 versus what? 25 over teen something, right? Yeah. What would you be feeling? I would say, you know, any kind of cardiac symptoms, shortness of breath, lethargy, pretty nonspecific. I don't think you'd feel any angina, you know, any pain in the chest. Maybe on exertion you might feel something like that. But yeah, that's why people can live until, you know, they can go 50 years before they really notice it, because maybe in a lot of cases it's not a very big hole. It's a little hole, but eventually it will catch up with you. Maybe. If it doesn't close over at all, then you'll probably be cyanotic. Then, of course, at birth, they would notice that. Your Apgar score, you know, would show up in your Apgar score. Okay? All right? But if it's just a small leak, you might not notice it for decades. The interesting thing about this PFO right now, probably not with the ventricular septal defects, but with foramen ovale, that could be done orthoscopically right now. Stanford started doing this a couple years back, so it's no longer really open heart surgery, open chest surgery, which is pretty fascinating. Okay, it can just be closed, and probably you can have this kind of heart surgery and be out of the hospital in a couple days. That's pretty amazing. Okay, otherwise it would have been weeks, right, if you had to have a thoracotomy and open up your heart and go on bypass and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so heart murmurs should be taken very seriously, because eventually they're going to kill the heart, no matter what the reason is. Okay, electrical activity of the heart. Okay, the myocardial cells are short, they're branched, right, and they're interconnected with gap junctions. Now, what can you tell me about a gap junction? What's a gap junction? It's a synapse. What kind of synapse? Electrical synapse, right? So when one cell in the heart depolarizes, then that depolarization could move from one cell to all the cells in that neighborhood through these gap junctions. Sodium currents can hop from one cell to another. Yeah.
How would you fix a heart murmur?
How would you hear a heart murmur?
With? How
would you fix it?
Yeah.
Well, depending on the nature, if it's a valve, they might be able to go in and reduce some adhesions or remove some plaques or something. All right. If the valve can't be repaired, then it has to be replaced. And of course, can't do that orthoscopically or endoscopically. Then that requires open heart surgery. And then you got to figure out what kind of valve you want. You want a cadaver valve? You want a pig valve? Those are all good. Or do you want a prosthetic valve? And nice thing about a prosthetic valve, for instance, is that you can't get an infection. You can't get AIDS or hepatitis from a prosthetic valve like you can from a cadaver. Cadaver is going to fit really well. A pig might not fit quite as well, but almost as nice as a human valve. With a pig valve, you don't have to worry about AIDS or hepatitis. But since it's tissue from another organism, your body's still going to try and reject it. If you get an artificial valve, you don't have to worry about rejection. But the thing about an artificial valve is that they have a tendency to form clots. So when you get an artificial valve, you got to be on anticoagulation therapy. Not so with those other tissue valves. So there's no clear choice. It's always a trade-off. So is that sort of your question? Yeah. And that's, you know, the job of the cardiologist to do the echocardiogram and maybe an MRI to see what the defect is. And if you can repair a valve, then by far that's what you want to do, if it's possible. Yeah. What about that artificial heart? I'm going to talk about that next semester. But I just don't have a whole lot of time to talk about that right now, okay, because I want to get through this chapter. But that's fascinating stuff, yeah. Artificial hearts or auxiliary hearts, and even taking skeletal muscle from another part of the person's body and graft it onto the heart. So that's an autograft. So that person is not going to reject that skeletal muscle that's been wrapped around their heart. And there's been a couple, I don't know how many, handfuls of documented cases where after they do an autograft, the skeletal muscle, which relieves a lot of the burden from the heart, after a period of maybe a year or 6 months or so, the heart regenerates and gets stronger, and so they don't even need the autograft anymore. Okay, so that's kind of new, right? So that's like an artificial heart, and then they don't have to, if they recover, then they don't even need an artificial heart. Okay, probably diet and exercise would be part of that regime as well. Yeah. Okay.
They had a mold of a heart.
Yeah.
They took all the cells off of it.
Okay.
They implanted it with your own human cells.
Yeah.
And wrote back a whole new heart.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
And your own heart.
So you don't have to reject it. Yeah, you won't reject it. Perfect. Yeah, so there's all kinds of different approaches that are being used, and yeah, it'd be nice to be around in 50 years to see what you can do with
the guy even had his fingers severed off, and he just implanted his own cell off it.
Yeah.
He bandaged it up, and he said in 4 weeks it grew back.
Okay. Yeah, so fascinating stuff. Okay, but let's press on. Okay. All right, so the heart, because of these gap junctions, electrical synapses, if one cell depolarizes, the whole heart can depolarize, and so the heart has a tendency to contract as a unit. Okay, and since the cells are all connected to each other, sometimes we call that a functional syncytium, right? They're all connected by these gap junctions. All right, so action potentials originating in any cell are transmitted to all others. Now, the only exception to that is what? That cap of fibrous tissue that's separating the atria from the ventricles. Electrical signals can't just go through connective tissue because muscle tissue, you remember, is sort of like nervous tissue. It has voltage-gated channels in it, right? And just like a neuron does. But connective tissue doesn't have those things inserted into the membranes of fibroblasts, so they can't conduct action potentials. So there is a layer of isolation between the atria and the ventricles. And the other funny thing about the heart is that, unlike skeletal muscle that needs innervation to contract, the heart does not need innervation, right? It will contract on its own, just like the smooth muscle that we looked at that was autorhythmic. The heart is autorhythmic as well, all right? And it's autorhythmic because of nodal cells. Nodal cells are specialized myocardial cells whose function is not really to contract like the rest of the heart, but to undergo special electrical activity, to spontaneously depolarize. The place that acts, that has the fastest rate of spontaneous depolarization in the normal heart is the sinoatrial node. You see it in the right atrium, pretty much at the junction of the superior vena cava on the anterior side, superior anterior side of the right atrium. This area depolarizes, and because of gap junction and the functional syncytium, that depolarization flows over both atria, causing the atria to contract. Right. That action potential then reaches, can't get through the fibrous skeleton of the heart, reaches the atrioventricular node. This is, again, some other special nodal tissue, and it holds on to the action potential, and then after a short period of time, it sends the action potential into the atrioventricular bundle, and you can see this is a passageway that takes electrical information from the atria and presents it to the ventricle. So this is how that coordinating signal for contraction moves from the atria into the ventricles. And because of the delay, that explains why the atria contract first. right? Because of a delay in the AV node. When action potential reaches the AV node, atrial ventricular node, then the rate of contraction speeds up. It's very, very fast. And it shoots down through the atrial ventricular bundle branches over here, down to the apex of the heart. And then these pathways right here are specialized myocardial cells. They're not nerves. They're still muscle cells. But remember, muscles have voltage-gated channels in them. And the signal reaches the apex. And then finally, the terminal branches of the conduction system called Purkinje fibers then allow the action potentials to spread into all of the myocardial cells at the apex of the heart. And what does that cause those myocardial cells to do? To contract, right? So the apical cells of the heart of the ventricles contract first, and then the signal moves up the lateral walls of the ventricles, causing these myocytes to contract progressively as you go from apex to base. Right, so the apex contracts first, and then the last part of the heart is the basilar regions of the ventricles. And that should probably make sense to you. You don't want the basilar regions or the basal regions of the ventricles to contract first, because which way is it going to force blood? It's going to force blood down to the apex. When all that blood gets to the apex, what's going to happen? Well, it's going to explode, and there's going to be blood all over the place. It would not be pretty. Okay. From the inside out, I don't think that's so important for us in here. Yeah, just curious. It's because of where tension develops when you have a thick muscle. The part of the muscle that has to work the hardest is the inner part right here, not the outer part. And indeed, when somebody has interruption of blood flow to the heart, it's this inner layer that is damaged before the outer layer over here. Yeah, so this, the inner layer is the part that's doing most of the work. It's contracting first. And that's the layer that's most in jeopardy when you're having a heart attack. Here's the epicardium, right? The epicardium is the membrane on the outside surface of the heart. And the first layer of muscle, of course, this is all myocardium, but the myocardium has layers as well. The first layer underneath the epicardium is called the subepicardium. And then this is the subendocardium over here. All right, and it's the subendocardium, or that inner layer, that does most of the work, that contracts first and actually gets damaged to a greater degree when somebody's having a heart attack. So the heart is not all the same all the way through. This is true. So it's really cool that you want to know something about layers, because when you start practicing medicine, layers mean everything, right? Layers of blood vessels, layers of the skin. That's how you stage disease and figure out how to treat people, by knowing what's happening in different layers. Okay. So the SA node is spontaneously active. It depolarizes. And I think this next slide right here shows what an action potential looks like in nodal tissue. All right, so here's a plot of voltage versus time. And what can you tell me about a resting membrane potential? There's no stimulus in this diagram whatsoever. This is just the nascent electrical activity of nodal cells. What does a resting membrane potential look like in this slide right here? Well, I see something about minus 60, but you see a flat area? It's never just stationary and stable. This membrane potential is changing all the time. All right, so this right here is basically the resting membrane potential, but what is it doing? It's drifting, right? It's drifting up towards zero, means that these cells are always continuously doing what? They're depolarizing. Because there are sodium channels that we call the HCN channels in nodal tissue that leak sodium, and when they leak sodium, what happens? It depolarizes. And then when these cells depolarize to this point right here, look what happens. You get an action potential. So what is this point right here called? This is the threshold. Okay? All right, so these nodal cells continuously depolarize. When they reach threshold, then an action potential ensues. This depolarization is due to opening of voltage-gated calcium channels, which causes a very fast depolarization. And then repolarization is due to opening of the slower potassium channels, just like what you're familiar with. And then it reaches membrane, resting membrane potential again. But what happens? It doesn't stay there. Again, it starts to depolarize because of these HCN channels, and that's going to start another action potential, even without innervation. All right, so the heart is spontaneously active as a result of that. And the slope or the rate of depolarization will determine how frequently or what the frequency of these action potentials are, which is going to determine the heart rate. So for instance, if this slope was a lot more shallow, instead of at this rate, if the slope was now like this, what would happen to the heart rate? Would it speed up or slow down? It would slow down. And so that is one way that the heart rate is regulated. Okay, we're going to talk about that in the next chapter. Okay. Ectopic pacemakers. Well, let's see. We said that the only way for signals from the sinoatrial node to get into the ventricles is via this atrioventricular node right here. Well, if somebody has had damage to their heart, maybe a heart attack in this part of their heart, then these nodal cells are dead and they're not going to conduct electrical signals. So there's no way for any electrical signals to go from an atrium into the ventricles. And you might say, well, I can understand how the atria are going to contract, but now what's going to cause the ventricles to contract if they're not receiving a signal from the atria? Well, all of these nodal tissues in here spontaneously depolarize, right? But typically they have a much shallower slope, so that the only pacemaker that's working in the heart is the one that has the steepest slope, which is the SA node. So some other part of the ventricle then is going to reach threshold eventually, and some other part of the ventricle is going to act like the pacemaker for the ventricles here. We call that an ectopic pacemaker. Okay, so an ectopic pacemaker will eventually develop, so the atria will contract at one rhythm, and the ventricles then would contract at another rhythm as a result of that. Okay, so somebody can still have a fairly functional heart with an ectopic pacemaker. Okay. Okay, I think I talked about that already. Myocardial cells. No, myocardial cells. These are different than nodal cells. All right, so these are the cells really that are specialized for contraction inside the heart. They do have a resting membrane potential of minus 90 millivolts, and it's pretty stable. Right, and but when they are stimulated and depolarized to threshold, and an action potential causes them to depolarize. Right, and that action potential usually comes from the SA node. And this is what an action potential of a contractile cell looks like, as opposed to a nodal cell. So again, this is just a plot of voltage, this transmembrane voltage versus time. And when a cell reaches threshold, sodium channels open up. You have this rapid depolarization phase due to sodium. Now, how is this different than an action potential that you've seen from, say, a neuron? Does it look similar? Or does it look radically different? A lot different. How is this different than the regular action potential that you saw with a neuron? Okay, say that again. This repolarization phase takes a lot longer. Yeah, slow. It's really, really slow. As a matter of fact, once the cell depolarizes, this repolarization is so slow that it actually stays depolarized for a long period of time. All right, this is usually what we call the plateau phase of a myocardial cell, and this is due to calcium channels that open up that allow calcium to enter the cell. When a positive ion enters the cell, what does that cause? Depolarization. Yeah, depolarization. So this plateau phase is due to these calcium channels. All right, and then slowly they close, and then the potassium channels that are open, they slowly kind of win out, and that causes repolarization of these myocardial cells. Now, here's the beauty of this kind of scheme. All right, in the neuron action potential, all right, how come action potentials don't summate? Can you think of an action potential from a neuron? And why don't action potentials summate? What is something special about this area underneath an action potential for a neuron. What did we call that? Oh, the absolute refractory period, right? So action potentials on neurons can't summate because of this refractory period. Well, it's the same thing for this action potential as well in the heart. This whole area right here is a refractory period, which means what? Another action potential can't come along, right, and stimulate the heart to contract again. So that just means that the heart itself can't go into tetanus, like other kinds of skeletal muscles in your body, right? Have you ever been walking down the sidewalk and you get a cramp in your leg or your arm or something, and the heart and that skeletal muscle just contracts and you do everything to get it to relax? What would happen to you if that was your heart? If it contracted and then it never relaxed? Well, yeah, 3 seconds you'd lose consciousness, 3 minutes you'd be, what, brain dead. Right? So it's really a good thing. The heart can't go into tetanus because it has these extra and special calcium channels that have this plateau phase in the action potential. So you can never get summation of heart muscle, right? You can't get summation of twitches of heart muscle, so the heart can't go into tetanus. It has to relax before it contracts again. And when it relaxes, what does it do? The heart fills with blood so that when it contracts again, it can pump blood. Right? So do y'all see the beauty of this plateau phase right here? And that's important. Okay. Okay, I think I talked about all this stuff. Conduction system of the heart. You know, you got to make sure, I think this is probably an exam figure. You do have to know SA node, AV node, the AV bundle, right? The bundle branches down here, and then the terminal branches, the Purkinje fibers. That's just kind of a quick review from anatomy. And then this just talks about the delay going through the AV node, and then the speeding up of the conduction speed down through the bundle branches through the Purkinje fibers so that the apical regions of the heart contracts first. Okay. Excitation-contraction coupling, I think we talked about already in terms of cardiac muscle. It's very similar to skeletal muscle. All right, so there's calcium that's released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and then calcium binds to troponin, and that stimulates the contraction of the heart muscles. And then diastole happens, the heart starts to relax when calcium is pumped out of the cell back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so this slide right here just shows you what we were talking about, and that is the absolute refractory period. Trace B right here shows the force of contraction, right? So that's a mechanical event, right, that's superimposed onto the electrical event, the depolarization or the action potential of a myocardial cell. And so you see this refractory period just doesn't allow the heart to summate. All right, so it can't go into tetanus. Yeah.
The skeletal muscle and cardiac, they both have excitation coupling.
Yeah, the big difference is that in skeletal muscle you have those mechanically gated receptors between the T tubule and the sarcoplasmic reticulum, namely what, the ryanodine receptor. You don't have ryanodine receptors in myocardial cells. You just have calcium-induced calcium release channels. So as soon as the T-tubule depolarizes, calcium enters the myocardial cell from the extracellular fluid, and that little bit of influx of calcium causes the calcium-induced release channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum to open up, and then a lot of calcium floods out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum into the myocardial cells. Yeah, because of calcium-induced. It's not a mechanical coupler like you do have in skeletal muscle. And everything else is pretty much the same. Okay, pretty much the same. You got troponin. It's only in smooth muscle that you have, what, calmodulin. All right, so here is your ECG that you've measured before. All right, and this P wave, the primavera wave right here, the first wave of the ECG, is due to depolarization of the atria, right? And then there's a delay. There's a PR interval, right? And the QRS complex represents depolarization of the ventricles, and you should know why the atria depolarize before the ventricles do. That's because of the, what? The delay in the AV node, right? Okay, so P wave represents atrial depolarization. QRS represents, this is what? Ventricular depolarization. Here is a long plateau phase, and then here is, what is this right here? This is repolarization of the ventricles. So the T wave represents repolarization of the ventricles. All right, so what didn't I mention? I mentioned ventricular depolarization and repolarization, but I only mentioned atrial depolarization. Do the atria ever repolarize? Absolutely. They have to repolarize before they can depolarize again. Where does atrial repolarization take place? At the same time as ventricular depolarization. So in the QRS complex, this waveform right here represents two things: atrial depolarization and ventricular depolarization. And the atria repolarization is such a small signal that you can't really see it because there's so many millions more ventricular cells than you have atrial cells that most of the signal is coming from the ventricles when they depolarize. So one way to think of that, if you were to go outside right now, the sun is out, of course, but are there other stars in the sky? Absolutely, right? The stars don't go away in the rest of the universe, but can you see those stars during the day? They're there, you just can't see them. And why is that? Because the sun is so bright, right? So for the same reason, when you look at the QRS signal right here, the signal from the ventricles is so huge, you can't really see any signal from the atria because it's such a small signal, okay? But that still happens during this point in time right here. All right, so here are the three distinct waves, the P wave, the QRS, and the T wave, and what they're caused by. So those definitions you should know. All right, so remember, ECG waveforms are not a measure of contraction. They are strictly what? Electrical events. That signal for contraction. All right, so what do you call a machine that acquires and records an ECG? It's an electrocardiograph. Okay, electrocardiograph. What do you call a machine that actually prints it on a piece of, what is that piece of paper called? That's an electrocardiogram, right? So maybe just know the difference between a graph and a graph. Just like a telegraph is what? Does somebody give you a telegraph? No, somebody gives you a what? Telegram. That used to be, now you get emails. I know you don't know what a telegram is anymore. Okay, but a telegram is a piece of paper with information on it, and a telegraph is the machine that you use to send it someplace. Okay. All right, so which events occur first in the heart? Mechanical contraction or electrical events? Electrical happen first, right? Okay. All right, so here is a nice slide that shows these events, and depolarization is in this nice color, like an orange, and then repolarization is like in this green color. Did I memorize the colors right? Okay. All right, so here is orange, and you can see this orange flows over both atria before any place in the ventricle, right? And that's because of the functional syncytium, because of all the gap junctions. And then what happens? That signal then gets through the AV node, down the bundle branches, down to the apex. All right, so what part of the ventricles start to depolarize first? It's the apical regions, right? And then during this period of time, when the ventricles start to depolarize, what about the atria? They start to repolarize. So hopefully that's a nice like green color up over here that's showing atrial repolarization the same time as the ventricle depolarizes, right? Then the ventricles depolarize completely, and then what happens? Then they repolarize. Okay. We talked about heart sounds already. This is just a nice figure in your book. This might be an exam figure too. You should just know the first and second heart sound due to closure of which valves, right? The AV valve versus the semilunar valve. Structure of blood vessels. Okay. This again is just a review from anatomy, so I'm not going to talk much about this, but here are some review questions that I thought of that are sort of interesting that you should be aware of. Material can enter or leave the blood only through what kind of blood vessel? What kind of blood vessel allows for exchange? And you're right, it's a capillary. Now you should probably also know why. Why is that so? Because arteries and veins have multiple layers and they're thick. The walls of arteries and veins are thick. The wall of a capillary is thin, made up of only one layer, the endothelium. So diffusion can take place through what? The thin wall of a capillary. And some capillaries even have spaces between the cells that allow for even enhanced exchange. So diffusion can only happen through short distances, like across the wall of a capillary. The walls of arteries and veins are way too thick for diffusion to take place. All right, what structure regulates blood flow through a capillary? Not all capillary beds are open, depending on the activity of those tissues. Some of those tissues receive blood flow and other tissues don't. Okay, like right now, your leg muscles aren't receiving blood flow because you're not using them. But mine are because I'm standing. Okay, what's regulating? What's allowing blood to flow through those or not flow through those capillary beds? There is something called a precapillary sphincter. The precapillary sphincter. There's a slide in here. All right, so precapillary sphincter. If you're not familiar with that, you probably need to go back and look at, I'll show you maybe, or go back in your book and look. Name two mechanisms which help return blood to the heart. So we said that blood will flow from high pressure to low, but all the pressure in your veins is very low. So how does blood move from veins back to the heart? How does it get back to your heart? This is a concept from anatomy. Two mechanisms. Muscles, that's right. So for instance, in order for me to describe this, actually, you know what I got to do? I got to say something about this next question. Name the three types of cardiovascular structures that have valves. So, veins have valves. What else has a valve? Your heart has a valve. And then the third one, maybe you're not so familiar with, is your lymphatic system has valves. But arteries don't have valves. All right, so now let's go back to this one right here. Mechanisms which help return blood to the heart. All right, so here we have a vein. And when we contract a muscle like that, that pressurizes the blood in the veins. And which way is it going to squirt if you contract the muscle? Like when I turn this biceps into that incredibly hard structure right there. What happens to that blood that was in that muscle? It gets squirted out, right? Because that skeletal muscle pressurizes the blood. Which way is it going to squirt? Is it going to squirt back toward my extremity? Or is it going to squirt back toward my heart? To your heart, because of all the valves that only allow blood to flow back to the heart. So the skeletal muscle pump is one other thing. And does anybody know what the second one is? Your respirations, okay? So when you expand your thoracic cavity and depress your diaphragm, you increase your thoracic volume, and that decreases the pressure inside your chest. And so when you increase your thoracic volume, what happens to air? It rushes inside your lungs because there's low pressure inside your lungs. So that's one thing that happens. But if there's low pressure in your thoracic cavity, guess what else rushes into your thoracic cavity? Not just air through your nose, but blood that's in all the veins gets sucked back into your thoracic cavity, returning it to the heart. So those two things work to return blood to the heart. Okay, which layer is responsible for forming valves? Okay, the valves of the heart are made by the endocardium, and the valves and veins are made by the endothelium. It's what, just a simple squamous epithelium that lines the heart or lines blood vessels. And it's either called the endocardium or endothelium. That's what valves are made out of. What's the difference between a sphincter and a valve? They regulate flow, okay, but they're a little bit different. What the heck is a difference? If I were to say orbicularis oculi, what's that? It's a circular skeletal muscle around your eye, right? Makes you close your eyes, or orbicularis oris, close your mouth, right? And that's an active way of closing your eyes, right? When muscle contraction. A sphincter is a circular muscle, but it's not skeletal. It's smooth muscle. So a sphincter is contraction that's under active control by contraction of that muscle. All right, a valve, on the other hand, is not muscle tissue, it's what? It's just endothelium. And that valve that's made out of endothelium closes when blood tries to flow backwards. It automatically closes. So a sphincter can stop flow either antegrade or retrograde. A valve can only stop retrograde flow. And a sphincter works when it contracts, and a regular valve can't contract, right? It's just endothelium. It just flops back and forth. But a sphincter can contract, occluding that blood vessel. All right, so here's that precapillary sphincter at an entrance to a capillary bed. Let's see, is there anything else I want to say? Here is an example of a valve in a vein, right? And when these muscles contract, that pressurizes this blood. And which way can it squirt? It can only squirt back up toward the heart as a result of that. It can't squirt back down into an extremity as long as this is a healthy valve. But not everybody has healthy valves. What's that condition called when this vein right here has been distended so much that the valve leaflets don't approximate each other anymore? They just flop back and forth. Okay? And that's called varicose veins. Okay? Is that what you said? Yeah, varicose veins. Okay? Okay, so that's it for this chapter. And so I guess what I wanted to show you, we can go over this real quick, is if Blackboard is still alive. Where do I have study guides? In documents? No. Assignments. Study guides. Exam 4. So you got a test next time, right? Yeah? On 12 and 13. Okay? And here is that exam figure from your book. So let's see if we can go over some of this real quick. So what do I want to do? I probably want to save target as. Okay, I'll save it there. Okay, and then I want to say open. Where did I put it? Did I put it down here somewhere? Do you see it? Oh, right here by the cursor. Fantastic. All right, so this one right here. So what do we got on this slide? Let me turn around and look. We have pressure. Okay, here is pressure in the aorta. Here is pressure in the ventricle. All right, so what is normal systemic pressure? What should that be? 120, and is it 120 over 80 for the aorta? Yeah, so that looks like nice normal blood pressure. What are the ranges of blood pressure in the ventricle? From 0 to 120 right here, and then here is atrial pressure. All right, and so here you can see what, the whole heart cycle. Right over here, I've modified the diagram a little bit to include it from the beginning of P wave to the beginning of a P wave. That's a whole heart cycle. And that heart cycle is made out of what? Systole and then diastole. And then here's the ventricular volume. Here we see a little bump up in ventricular volume. What's causing this little bump in ventricular volume right here? That's when what happens after the P wave? The atria contract and they pump a little bit of extra blood into the ventricle, but you can see how minuscule an effect that is. So your atria really don't perform much of any kind of cardiac function, right, in a normal individual. So that increases. And then what about the volume right here? It looks flat. So this period of time is called what? The isovolumetric period of contraction. Notice that the blood is in the ventricles is being pressurized, but it's not being ejected from the ventricles. Pressure is increasing. The volume stays the same because both the atrioventricular valve and semilunar valve is closed, right, during this period of time. So this is isovolumetric contraction. And then right at this period of time, when the pressure in the ventricle exceeds that of the aorta, That's when the aortic semilunar valve opens, and then blood is ejected from the heart, which we see here. All right, so this, so what do we call this value right here? This is end diastolic volume, and this volume is the end systolic volume. The difference between the two is stroke volume. Okay, and then when the ventricular pressure goes below the aortic pressure, what happens here? Blood tries to go back from the aorta into a ventricle, but it can't because the aortic semilunar valve closes. That produces the second heart sound. And then this little, as the valve closes, that puts a little notch in the aortic pressure right there. That's what we call the dicrotic notch when the semilunar valve closes. All right, and so then we have relaxation of the ventricles, and we have diastole. And during diastole, what happens to the size or the volume of the ventricles? During diastole, they fill with blood, so their volume goes up. So the greatest volume is at the end of diastole, end diastolic volume. All right, so that shows all your interesting parts for a cardiac cycle. All right, so that you have on Blackboard. Yeah.
Is there any way we can, is that label on Blackboard too?
I didn't put the key up there, but maybe later tonight I'll put the key up there. But I think you don't want to just memorize those letters. You really probably want to understand what's going on there. All right, so try to work with it quite a bit without looking at the key. I just didn't have time because Blackboard hasn't been working for the last couple of days. So hopefully it will work, keep working all day today and tomorrow. Oh, I forgot. Yeah, so who's got the sign-in sheet? It's up here?
Yeah, it's coming down.